from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, African Americans make up just over 12% of the U.S. population, but account for nearly half of the 1 million people infected with AIDS in this country.
When you look at the AIDS epidemic in Black America, and you think about Black America as if it were a country unto itself, it would have the 16th worst AIDS epidemic in the world.
That was Phil Wilson, who is founder of the Black AIDS Institute. He's in a new documentary we'll be discussing the hour ahead. We'll talk with the filmmaker Renata Simone about her frontline documentary, Endgame, AIDS in Black America. And we'll talk with two African-American East Bay residents living with the disease next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Well, as I said earlier, Black people make up just over 12% of the population in the United States, but account for nearly half of the 1 million people who are infected with HIV in our country. And later on this evening, a new PBS Frontline documentary on AIDS in Black America will air. It's called Endgame, and we want to focus our attention in this Forum Hour on the high rate of HIV infection in America's Black population and look at what's being done and what needs to be done in the future. Joining us from Boston is Renata Simone, who is producer, director, and writer of the Frontline documentary Endgame, AIDS in Black America, which will air tonight on KQED Television at 10 p.m. And welcome to the program. Good to have you with us this morning.
Oh, good morning, Michael. It's just an honor to be with you. I'm a longtime fan of your work, and thank you for your interest in the film.
Thank you for those kind words, and I also want to introduce to our listeners two people who are with us in studio. Nell Davis, his story is featured in the documentary Endgame, and welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I am honored to be here today.
Glad to have you. Honored to have you. And Jesse Brooks, likewise, who's a journalist who writes for the Oakland Post News Group and is an AIDS activist in Oakland, also featured in the documentary Endgame. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
And I mentioned that both Jesse and Nell have AIDS. And let's talk to the filmmaker first before we hear the stories of our two guests and hear from them. This is a film which really puts a human face on AIDS in the Black community and gives us a historical chronicle of it, I ought to add. Takes us back in time, and we'll talk about that. The statistics are first of all, the most astonishing to many people because they're just not aware of them. Can you run those on for us, Renata?
Well, sure. You know, as Phil Wilson encapsulates at the beginning of the program, every day about 156 people get infected with HIV and half are Black. And the other one that really just gets people's attention is that if Black America was a country unto itself, it would be number 16 in the world, having the 16th worst AIDS epidemic in the world. You know, we think of Africa, we think of other countries, but we don't realize that we have this problem here too.
And we also have a number of other problems related to this. In many respects, what I think you come to early on in the film, which is the divide right here in the Bay Area. You go across the bridge to Oakland and you have a very different perspective and a very different revelatory sense of AIDS afflicting the Black community than you do in San Francisco. It's like two worlds, really.
It is two worlds, and it exists everywhere. It's not just in the Bay Area. But the Bay Area, having the bridge and the bay, it's very visual, and I used it as a motif later in the film, bridges and gulfs between populations. And, San Francisco gets a lot of coverage for this issue, and Oakland, not so much.
Well, I'd like to actually have our listeners hear a cut from the film. This is brings us into the world of AIDS and prostitution over on 14th Street in Oakland. Willie Dudley is a recovering addict and needle exchange coordinator in Oakland, and he takes the film crew on a driving tour through East Oakland to point out connections between drug use and prostitution and unsafe sex.
This East 14th is mostly everything from selling crack to sex work to hustling, in whichever form that they can get that in. That's what this is, the main street that that mostly goes down on. Yeah, she's one of our regulars. She's about 16. When you're on the influence crack. Sometimes if a guy says, I give you $20 more if you don't use a condom, generally she'll say, well, okay. Whereas if she's got a lot of money, she'd be like, nah, dude, if you ain't got no condom, that's only what we're going to do. Unless, of course, he said $50. And then she'll be like, okay, but I'm going to remember you. She tried to put a fear in him. But generally, they'll do what they have to do. And that puts them more at risk.
Well, there it is. And that's actually from the film Endgame, AIDS in Black America. And there are many elements, of course, to what causes AIDS and the origins of AIDS and why it's so high in the black population. But a big one is obviously drugs and prostitution. And the film really focuses on part of that, which is only part of the story. But also, I'm struck by the title of the film, Endgame, aside from also being a title of a Samuel Beckett play. You really are, in a sense, trying to bring across the necessity to go after the sources and do something about ending AIDS.
Right. I do think that we know how bad the problem is. I think what I tried to do in the film was, first of all, help people to care about the subject by introducing people who are very familiar to us and very accessible and about which we end up caring because they're just so terrific and courageous. And there they are. We have them with us today, two of them. But I also called it Endgame because now, in the 30th year of the epidemic, we have the tools. We have drugs for treatment. We know prevention works. And it's a preventable tragedy. We all have tragedies in our lives that came out of nowhere. But this one is preventable. So let's do it.
Easier said than done, Jesse Brooks.
Right.
Huh?
I agree.
Let's get you on record here. I mean, this is a staggering problem and very formidable in terms of what's faced at getting at the cause and the roots of the problem.
You're right, Michael.
Let's talk about it from your perspective. I mean, you certainly have been an AIDS activist for many years now. You've seen the street. You've experienced it. You've lived it. What can the public do, and what should the public know about what they can do?
Well, I agree with Renata, and I think, Renata, I want to thank you for telling the story so well and weaving the story and all the factors that brought us to today. And to remind people that HIV stands for human, and if we would have got that in the beginning, that it was a human virus instead of a white gay male virus, we wouldn't be where we are now.
Yeah, the film does a good job of pointing out how the media really made it seem initially like a white male problem.
Exactly.
A gay male problem, yeah. Talk about your own experience. I mean, you have AIDS.
I have AIDS, and I've known since 1993. At that time, people were dying every day. I saw my brother die, who died in 91 of AIDS. And so when I contracted AIDS and finally got the results, because there's a big barrier in getting your results. And so the most important thing a person can do today is to get their results. So I'm really glad that I finally got my results. I didn't take the results so well. So I went back into addiction, as you just played a clip, that a lot of people suffer other issues than just HIV and AIDS. We're talking about mental health. We're talking about addiction. Mine was addiction. And finally, addiction was about to kill me. It's when I wanted to live. And that's when the secret of HIV was more important to tell that for me to live than to keep it a secret any longer. And so ever since then, I've been talking, and you can't shut me up.
Well, a lot of people aren't talking, though. I mean, there's a culture of silence, really, and a great fear of coming out and talking about it that's been characteristic of this disease from the beginning.
That's true, but I see the tides changing as we talk about the end games. Because in the beginning, again, as Renata said, that we have San Francisco, this big city, then we have Oakland, which we call it a shadow city that is so overshadowed by this big city that it doesn't get the attention. So when HIV/AIDS came out, there was big, loud voices in San Francisco, and Oakland was silent until the point where we are now, and we can't afford to be silent anymore. So that's why I do what I do. I'm on posters. showing my face that this is what the face of HIV looks like, that we have to break down the stigma of who is at risk for HIV.
How is the silence different specifically from your judgment in the black community? I mean, I know they have this whole phenomenon, for example, the download. There's a lot of homophobia, but why is it? Are those the main factors? What are the main factors that make it more silent?
Well, I think it's just for me, growing up in my family, in my culture, we've always had this pink elephant syndrome. And for me, the pink elephant syndrome is when the real important issues are in the middle of the floor, but the family argues and talks about anything else but to really identify the real issues. So any kind of healing has to start with identifying that there is a problem.
Yeah, I want to, in fact, hear another cut from the film because it brings attention to the black churches and it brings attention to the kind of homophobia that, unfortunately, is all too prevalent in the black churches. This is a third cut, Danny.
In 1985, I went to do a talk for the Black Ministerial Alliance in Los Angeles to talk about HIV and AIDS. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. I'm in a church full of black ministers, and I'm talking to them about, you know, HIV and why they get involved. And a minister stood up, and he was absolutely irate. And he said, "We're not going to let them blame this one on us." And I was stunned. And I took a deep breath, and I said, "Okay, can you tell me how many of us have to die? How many of your sons, your daughters, your sisters have to die before this is about us?"
That's Phil Wilson, who's founder of the Black AIDS Institute. And as he said, he went back in 1985 to a black ministerial conference and had that experience. I want to bring Nell Davis into our discussion here. And Nell Davis' story is featured in the documentary Endgame. These are all compelling stories, and these are all dramatic stories. Yours, in some ways, stands by itself. You were married to someone who, well, had AIDS and didn't tell you.
Yes. Unfortunately, yes. Was in 2003, December 23rd. The young man was a member of my church, a deacon in the church. And I, at the time, I really didn't know too much about him. I was attracted to him, but I didn't really know anything personally about him. So I inquired around to see, you know, if he was married or was he in a relationship, you know, with someone there in the church. So I went to my pastor and asked about him, you know. So pastor said he's a good man, you know, good man. You have my consent, in a sense of speaking. So we basically bumped into each other, literally bumped into each other. And that's how that all started.
The romance.
Yes.
And it was a good romance, good marriage, pretty much, wasn't it?
We had a lot in common. A lot in common. He was, you know, funny, and I liked to walk, run, beach, so forth. So we, you know, enjoyed that together. And most of all, you know, we are Christians. We, you know, we had the same thing in common. And so we, yes, we did. We enjoyed a year of engagement. And at that, we set a wedding date. And we both agreed to get married in our church. At that time, we had to go through a 6-week marriage counselor, you know, counseling. So we did. Had a beautiful wedding at our church. My children, you know, all was there. My grandchildren was the wedding party. So everything was wonderful.
It's like a happy ever after type of story almost,
yes,
at least for a while.
Yes, for a while.
And then when did you discover that you had AIDS? That you had HIV, excuse me.
Approximately about a year. about a year into the marriage. And that was...
How did that discovery take place?
Well, it took place in our bedroom. Like I said, my ex-husband was a deacon in the church. So he carried his Bible. You know, it was a confidential thing that he kept in his car, which I respected. But this particular time, he brought it in the house, and it was by the side of his bed. So I was making the bed that morning. He was not there. So I accidentally bumped the Bible. It was not, you know, zipped up. So the content of it fell out. So as I tried to gather it all up, you know, to put it back in, which I just felt really weird because it was like I was invading, you know, all of this confidential privacy. So I was trying to hurry up and nervously get it back in the compartments that it was in. So this one particular letter, it was a long business form letter that was folded in half. I couldn't get that one back. I couldn't find the compartment to get that one back in there. So just, you know, a little jittery there trying to hurry up and get it in there. So I had this awful burning sensation that you need to read this letter. Can't really express. Now I know it was the Holy Spirit guiding me to read that letter. So went through a few seconds of that. So I finally sat on the end of the bed and I opened it up. At first, I looked at the address where it came from. And I just kind of thought, you know, what is this? So I opened it up and that was pretty devastating.
It revealed the fact that your husband was afflicted and had the date. But what's... and it was from?
It was from the blood bank.
From the blood bank. Yeah, this is from the year before you were married, though, wasn't it?
Yes.
And so when you're profiled in the film, you talk about this as being the ultimate betrayal of your trust. You confronted him. He lied even repeatedly about...
Yes.
Even though he knew when he married you he had HIV.
Yes.
And yet you were able to say in the wake of all that, I love him.
And I did. I did. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the love part there that was, I would say, was the devastating part of it. It was the lying and the betrayal because I trusted him. You know, with my life, I literally did. And this is a person that loved me, as he said.
But could have killed you and, in fact, gave you something that made you feel suicidal. And even your pastor said you should prosecute him.
Yes. And I was, you know, that was suggested to me not only by my pastor, you know, my doctors and, you know, my children and friends and... You know, so, but at that time, I was devastated with the dishonesty, the betrayal. But I knew at that time I could no longer trust him, and I didn't have respect for him, simply because how could you love me and not share this with me, and you didn't even, you know, take care of yourself. So basically, you didn't love yourself, you know, to go and seek medical attention. So, you know, that told me that you really didn't love me.
And now you live with HIV?
Yes.
Again, Nell Davis here with us. Story featured in the documentary Endgame. There's just, let me go back to the filmmaker for a moment, Renata Simone, again, who's with us from Boston, and the film is called Endgame. It airs tonight on KQED-TV at 10. The stories are so poignant, and it seems like, in many respects, Renata, you were ambitious enough to try to show many different kinds of stories and make them even more of kind of panoply of humanity.
Well, you know, my sister, even my sister who has followed my work over many years, and I first started covering HIV in the 80s, she watched the film and she said, Renata, I had no idea so many different kinds of people were infected with HIV. So that's coming from someone who'd been following. But I have to tell you that Nell is not unusual. I mean, the tragedy is that each of the people in the film is not alone. There are people like every one of them across the country. And when I would go to places like South Carolina and Memphis where we didn't end up filming, people would say, I'd tell them the story of Nell's experience, and they'd say, oh, that's Teresa who lives in Riverdale. And I say, no, that's Nell who lives in Oakland. And it was just devastating to know that Nell's not alone, but I knew then that her story would be even more important to include.
Well, you include a good deal of historical background as well. We see Magic Johnson, for example, and I mean, the effect of his becoming public about having HIV was extraordinary. He was a basketball star and a man of who was an iconic figure, great admiration. And capture those moments that really sort of shake up, well, you know, Rock Hudson is often cited as an example.
Right.
But for the black community, Magic Johnson was much bigger.
Right.
And also the kind of surprise of President Bush as the second President Bush going forward with $18 billion, trying to really make us aware of the fact that we need to do something, and we need to continue to do something, and just in terms of our awareness, our consciousness.
Absolutely, and I think at the time when George Bush did that, $15 billion over 5 years, and then there was more, as you point out, the activists had a dual reaction. On one hand, they thought this was terrific. On the other hand, they saw the money rushing overseas, and people knew that there was a problem. As Bambi Gaddist from South Carolina points out, you know, she says, I'm in Africa right now. Every time I diagnose another teenager positive, I'm in Africa. And, you know, I think it was frustrating, but at the same time, people felt positive about the surge in overseas money.
You also went to Atlanta and showed what goes on in prisons. I mean, they don't separate people with HIV, and they don't give out condoms. They give out condoms, so as a result, they're almost sanctioning the idea that there's going to be sex.
Well, it's a state-by-state thing, and it's a very interesting controversy that I couldn't get into. But if you do separate people with HIV, the ACLU and others have really protested against that because the HIV-infected inmates are not then eligible for work release. And if you're not eligible for work release, then you can't get paroled. And they have brought lawsuits saying that this is cruel and unusual punishment and won in several places, including there. And, you know, at the same time, then you have people with HIV mixed in with people who don't and no way of protecting themselves, and it, you know, gets bad.
Renata Simone is producer, director, and writer of the Frontline documentary Endgame, AIDS in Black America, which airs on KQED television this evening at 10 p.m. And there wasn't, we ought to mention, any real national AIDS strategy until the year 2010. I want to bring you, our listeners, into this discussion. If you have questions or comments, join us now. Toll free, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Black people make up just over 12% of the population in the United States, but account for nearly half of the 1 million people infected with HIV in this country. We're talking with filmmaker Renata Simone about her Frontline documentary Endgame, AIDS in Black America, and we're talking to two African-American East Bay residents who live with the disease, Nell Davis and Jesse Brooks. They're all with us, and you can be with us as well if you have something you'd like to bring into the conversation or if you have something you'd like to contribute to the discussion. Questions or comments are welcome. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. or post any questions or comments you might have on our website by simply going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Or you can also contribute to the conversation by going to our Facebook page. And I wanted to hear another cut from the movie, the film that we've been talking about, the Frontline film Endgame, which will air tonight on KQED-TV at 10 p.m. And what we're going to hear next is Gregory Millett with the Office of AIDS Policy talking about the changes ahead.
Things have changed, and they've changed for the better, but they've also changed for the worse. And for the better is that we have medications that keep people living with HIV alive for much longer. They are less likely to get sick. They are less likely to look sick. But with that comes an invisibility, and that's where we are paying the price. People are engaging in behaviors that might place them at risk for contracting HIV. And you certainly see that with the younger population of young black men who have sex with men.
That's Gregorio Millett with the Office of AIDS Policy talking about the challenges ahead. And one of the big challenges, obviously, is the invisibility that continues. Let me go to a caller here. And Sonny, that's you. Join us from Benicia. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm a retired facility captain for the prison system here in California. And in 2007, there was a program out of San Francisco jail that came into the prisons. I was donned Captain Condom, so to speak, while we had this program of setting up condom machines within the housing units at Solano State Prison. But it kind of caused a dual situation where if inmates seen other inmates going to the machine, they would be targeted. That was some of the fear. The inmates thought we were setting them up to be targeted as being homosexual, gay, although we know that takes place, but a lot of the men don't consider themselves as being gay if they're a situated circumstance. So we had them up for about a year. The inmates didn't use them. You know, we allowed the inmates to carry two on them at all times. They wanted to. If they had more than two, they'd be charged because in the rule books, it's technically still, it can be written up for having sex with each other. So, you know, we tried it. It makes sense. But it was a lot of pressure with the inmates. They really didn't use the condoms out of the machine.
Well, thank you for those comments. And, let me go back to Jesse Brooks here. He was an AIDS activist in Oakland and writes for the Oakland Post as a journalist. Jesse, there's, again, that stigma that's so strong about male homosexuality within the black community. It accounts for a great deal of the invisibility, for the ongoing challenges that we've been talking about here, and also accounts for a great deal of the ongoing sense of what the problem is and lack of a solution.
You're right, Michael. Stigma, and as the caller just alluded to, I mean, that's the presence of stigma in prison system, in jail system, and stigma has killed people. That people would rather die than to go into a clinic that might be perceived as AIDS because they might be perceived as gay. And so we have to fight the stigma. I mean, HIV and AIDS is just like any other disease. It's like having diabetes. It's like having cancer. It's an illness, and it shouldn't be stigmatized.
How about from your perspective, Nell Davis? I mean, the stigma. I mean, your husband gave you the infection. You were completely unknowledgeable about the fact that he was infected. It's a very different perspective than, say, an addict or, you know, someone who's homosexual. But you felt the stigma, too.
Yes. Unfortunately, Michael, I did. And to me, that is still a big factor because there are some that have not even shared this with their families, the loved ones, because of the stigma. And even, you know, even in my church, there was some.
It occurred to me in your story that if your husband kept that from you, of course he could have kept other things from you, and he could have possibly infected other people too.
Possibility.
But no regrets for not going forward with following the advice that others told you about prosecuting him?
In the beginning, I had ups and downs, you know, trying to figure that out. But my main focus was on me, getting myself mentally and physically strong enough, you know, where I could take care of me. and my family.
Well, you were just so devastated at first, as I said earlier. I mean, you considered killing yourself, didn't
you? Yes, I did. Yes, I did. Because at that time, I really didn't know too much about HIV/AIDS. That was not part of my everyday concern. Because, living the lifestyle that I was living and trying to raise my children, and it just wasn't something that, like you said a moment ago, my take on that was it was a gay,
Wasn't right? going to affect you or your life, right?
That was my understanding, yeah. Lack of knowledge.
Can be a very disturbing and dangerous thing, as you
yes.
discover sometimes. Let me bring another caller onto this. Someku, good morning.
Yes,
Someku,
good morning.
Excuse me.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for the show. It's so important. I wanted to mention, in 1996, my 26-year-old brother died of AIDS in a prison hospice in Vacaville. And I remember him telling me the moment that he contracted HIV, he recalled it was in prison, and he knew it right then and there. Okay, I've got this for whatever reason. But one of the issues was the lack of education around condoms and the resistance of the California prison system at the time to get out of denial and allow these men, because obviously they're having sex, to use condoms. And I wanted to ask the filmmaker, first of all, thank you very much for your work. If you have any information regarding that, has that changed, especially in California prisons or, nationally? Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, we thank you for the question. Renata Simone.
I do know that it's under consideration everywhere, but that most states do not allow condoms in prisons. And when I was doing this film and doing the research, there were tough choices to make. And I did not focus on HIV in prisons. I didn't focus on HIV in drug users. I focused on people who would surprise everyone and sort of broaden our minds. Because we think of drug use, we think of prison, we think of gay white gay men when we think of AIDS. But the fact that we don't think of it as Nell or Jesse, that means that the virus is still secret and it has a way to spread. So I focused more on these more accessible stories.
Well, one of the things you focus on that is accessible and indeed as important as everything else we've been talking about is sex education. And the documentary actually profiled a young woman named Marva Lynn who got AIDS from her boyfriend as a teenager. And she said the abstinence-based sex education programs in her school didn't educate her enough about AIDS. Let's hear.
In high school, I was most athletic. My best friend was prom queen. I was a heterosexual, not promiscuous, all-American teenager. I was, just a normal girl. And just HIV and normal didn't go together. So I thought.
Again, Renata, you want to comment?
Marvelyn is, she'll tell you herself, she's marvelous and has real strength and has been doing some public speaking because she's like a lot of girls. At the beginning, she says that her AIDS education was in there was a book and there were pictures of kids in Africa and very, as she says, skinny, skinny, white, gay man. And she just felt that they were totally left out as young black high school kids. And that's the fastest growing group of people in the country is 18 to 24 young black kids. So the awareness was something that can be prevented so easily in some ways is just falling through the cracks.
And not only that age group, but also young women. I mean, the numbers are staggering here too, young black
Absolutely.
Women.
Yeah. Yeah, 85% of the women, well, it's about a third, but 85% of the women who have HIV are getting it heterosexually. So it's a very normal, you do not have to be a sex worker on 14th Street. It's something that nobody can tell by looking, people are taking meds and they look healthy, so you can't tell.
Again, Renata Simone is producer, yeah, director, and writer of the frontline documentary Endgame, AIDS in Black America. I wonder, Renata, if you'd respond to a listener who writes on our website. His name is Paul. What is the impact of black separation and separatism on the AIDS problem? One often hears black women saying they exclusively prefer black males, for instance, and at times it does seem that blacks are a country unto themselves by their own design, with separate universities, separate TV, separate movies, separate religion, and separate neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what happened was the HIV dug in the 80s when the black institutions that the writer is talking about did not pick up HIV as an issue. So you had the church turning away, as you had in the clip before. You had the universities not doing education. All the black institutions weren't, and the black leaders were not sounding the alarm. And in the film, I interview Julian Bond, who, you know, as a true leader should do, evaluates his own lack of leadership in those days and says, I was in a position of leadership and I should have done something and I didn't and I feel badly about myself. But he's doing it differently now. He was the first black leader to get tested in public. And, you know, it was just during those early years when there wasn't the leadership, when the church leaders turned away, the political leaders turned away, that the HIV spread. And now, because of what the writer was talking about, because black America can kind of be unto itself and people are choosing partners who are also black, since the virus is there, it is being spread. And that's really true. People say, why is it so much worse in black America? I say, well, it's like my friend who climbs Mount Everest a lot. It's because that it's there. That's where the virus is.
Well, you also, in the movie, touch upon neighborhoods that were destroyed by the crack cocaine epidemic. I mean, so the neighborhoods became essentially destroyed, as I said, and as a result, you had all of the afflictions that go into destroyed neighborhoods, poverty and all the rest, and more drug use, more and more addiction.
Right, and crack did two things, because, of course, crack is smoked, not injected, so you can't actually get HIV from smoking crack. But what it did was, especially for women, it made them desperate for money, and they ended up sleeping with people, exchanging sex for money. And it also, the response in our society to crack and to drug abuse in general was to criminalize it. And in the case of crack, the penalties for crack offenses were so much more severe than for cocaine offenses. And cocaine is more of a white drug. Crack is more used by black people. And so the crackdown on crack put many, many, many more people into prison. And then you connect into the system we talked about earlier in the program.
Many more into prison for longer, right. Longer
exactly.
Sentences.
Longer yeah. Sentences, yeah. Yeah. That's how you get to 100 times worse, yeah.
Bring in another caller. David, that's you. Thank you for waiting. Join us on Forum.
Yeah,
good morning.
I was wondering if you could just give us a few numbers about maybe like the top three ways, the top three transmission ways, and you know, is it drug use? Is it HIV? Is it sex between you know, casual unsafe sex? And then who is it? Is it how and who
within the black community? You're asking, yeah. Jesse Brooks, can you help us out here?
Yes. The highest transmission rates right now in any population, white and black, is MSMs, men that have sex with men, especially in the African-American community. It's really high transmission rates. And then the next highest rates are African-American women, that heterosexual transmission routes. And then IV drug use is also a high transmission route. And then there's different sexual acts that have different transmission rates that create high or low transmission.
Okay, let me thank you for the question, David, and let me move on to another caller, and that's Ron. Ron, you're on.
Hi. With student service under the Hope and Beyond Project, we go back to where we started in 92 for HIV/AIDS because of our work with toxic chemicals and the long-term body burden of toxic chemicals, how it related to HIV/AIDS, where it has an incubation period which may have symptoms or no symptoms for up to 10 years. And this brings us to the conclusion that there should be a level, specifically amongst teenagers, young adults, who may be hormonally more active than others, who do represent a hidden amount of HIV infection in this country, amongst all races, all people. And this hidden factor could be really a health problem, extensive in the near future. Shouldn't we consider for high schools, at least high schools, to offer HIV testing without stigma to the open population of the schools?
Can you respond to that, Renata Simone? Let me get your thoughts.
Lisa Fitzpatrick is a doctor in Washington, D.C., and we come to her at the end of the film. And she's very active in the effort to get doctors to normalize HIV testing so that if you went to the doctor for any reason at all and you were having a sugar test or a cholesterol test, that HIV would be in there and that your doctor would talk to you about it. And I think she would be very much endorsing what you're proposing. Yeah.
And let me thank the caller. When we also talk about ways of combating the spread, you touch on a number of things in the film that are important here and relevant. One is the success of interventions.
Mm-hmm. Which ones were you thinking of? There's so many.
Well, just talking about reducing HIV's spread with kids and partners by intervening, along with education, all the other things we're talking about is just part of a composite picture that needs to be, well, the
Absolutely.
Public needs to be more aware of, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing is the thing that the cost to society, I think, you know, why should we care? People don't realize that the care and treatment of people with AIDS, 63% of the people who are in care and treatment are paid for by the government. So if you don't sort of care about making those interventions for altruistic reasons, because we shouldn't have people in our society who are suffering from preventable things, we can also care because it's costing us a lot of money. The U.S. spent $18 billion with a B dollars last year on that care and treatment. So it's a lot of money. And I think, yes, there are social interventions, there are personal ones, like Nell's story really does illustrate how it comes down to one person at a time and how we have to figure out how to talk to each other about these things.
Well, we spoke earlier with both Nell and Jesse about the stigma, and Jesse Brooks, I'm just interested, over the years, if you've seen much of a change among young African Americans with respect to the stigma. Is it getting better?
I can't say that it's getting better, but all I know is that when I speak in the community, when people see me on posters, I've talked to Nell about this earlier, we have people that come up to us and say, finally, I'm able to talk about my son that died of AIDS, or I'm able to talk about my brother that died of AIDS. So the more people put a face on it, the more people stand up and say, I have HIV, the easier it allows someone else to do the same. Free people, free people.
A lot of that stigma, though, Renata Simone, goes right to the heart of, I mean, for example, the film portrays the double life in the clubs and the whole sense of a kind of subterranean world of, I mean, I know, I think I alluded to it before, this notion of the down low that we hear about, you know, black men, particularly because of the stigma of homosexuality, leading a secret life.
Yeah, I think Jesse can talk to this too, but from the perspective of a filmmaker, I think, and I've heard it coast to coast, it's just that the stakes are so high. You posed the question earlier, why is homophobia so much worse in the black community? And I think it is to some extent. Some people argue whether it is or it isn't, but I think it is. And I think people, gay men, keep the secret because it would cost too much to reveal. They may lose their church. That's a high likelihood. They may lose their family. They may lose their friends. And so it's just a much easier life to keep a secret. In fact, I interviewed someone in Selma, Alabama, who said he was so sorry he told people that it completely ruined his life. And he didn't have the economic means to move, to pick up and create a new life somewhere else. And he felt completely trapped by the fact that he had revealed just that he was gay. He wasn't HIV positive. He said it ruined his life. And with stakes like that, that's what keeps men who are who prefer to have sex with men in marriages with women. And, you know, that's very, very dangerous for everyone. So decreasing the stigma would serve everyone's purpose.
And could you talk about that, Nell Davis? In your case, was your husband having sex with other men? Did you find that out to be
no.
the case?
No. No. I have no idea.
He got HIV through heterosexual activity, to the best of your knowledge.
To the best of my knowledge. I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, why do you think, Jesse Brooks, this is so pervasive in the black community, the sense of, you know, everything, the stakes being so high, as Renata Simone puts it?
I don't think it's so pervasive, but I think because of the small population that we make up of the United States and in our communities, it's so critical to address these issues. But it also speaks to men and women still protecting themselves, and you can't trust people. So it speaks to the nature of HIV and not a certain population, but to the behavior.
And now, what have you been doing? I mean, you've taken a more active role. You've come out and told your story, which takes a great deal of courage, by the way, and I commend you for that. But in terms of just within your community talking to people.
I have I've done workshops throughout Oakland at some churches. I have my last out-of-state talking was in North Carolina. That was a few years ago, actually. And I volunteer Kaiser Permanente in Hayward. And this is basically counseling, trying to be a support to patients that is living with the virus or just newly diagnosed, trying to, you know, help them to understand that there is hope, and that, you know, trying to share my story with them to let them know that they're not alone, there is support. And it's amazing how some that still, the stigma, back to that word stigma, they will not and have not, you know, shared this with their loved ones, their parents, their children, and in some instance, their husbands, their wives. So they're living with this, with no support.
Let me ask you a very tough question in many ways, and that is, has it made you more open-minded personally toward, let's say, sex that comes, the infection coming from sex, from male-to-male sex, that sort of thing? Because so much of it is transmitted that way, as we heard just a moment ago from Jesse. Because the church has looked really down, strong, and you're a really very strong church person.
Yes. I would like to think so, but...
No, I think your faith has come across here, and it's impressive how much it served you, but within the church, within your community, there was always this view of homosexual sex as being something that also has a big stigma to it. So has your mind opened up more to that or been more tolerant?
Oh, definitely so. Definitely so. Because as I stated a little bit ago, you know, my knowledge was like zero, and I have worked in the medical field for over 30 years, you know, caring for others. But that particular issue was just not one of mine. So, yes, it has. And I've tried to educate my adult children, you know, getting them to do more research and learn more about the virus. And I have granddaughters of teenage years, you know, so trying to get them to realize that HIV/AIDS is for real. It is for real. And I've tried, you know, being for real with my grandchildren and my adult daughters, you know, so protect yourself, you know.
There's a listener named Laura who would like to know well, an opinion from any of you about what the most effective way you think is of getting information to the community. I think, sort of, Nell, you're suggesting just talk to your loved ones, talk to people you know, and do as much as you can to communicate. Want to add anything to that, Jesse? Or?
Yeah, I think the most important thing, you can educate yourself first.
Yes.
And to then you can educate your family, which entails, like, a pebble thrown in the water will ripple out to the community.
And what would you like the community to come away with from your film, Renata Simone?
I think I've always tried to give people a long-distance, first-person experience. I think the take-home message is that there's really not much room for judgment, that people who are in the path of the HIV are no different from us. We, under circumstances like the ones we see in the film, these would be our lives, and I think the judgment is what fuels the stigma, and it just becomes this vicious cycle. But on practical terms, I think I'd say get tested. 25% of people who are infected don't know it, and that's got to be a first.
And as the film points out, there are those who are born with it as well. I mean, it's a big picture, and film I want to recommend again, Frontline documentary, Endgame, AIDS in Black America, which will air 10 o'clock tonight on KTV, KQED-TV. Goes right up against a repeat of Forum, but you can do both, actually. You can TiVo, and you can all kinds of ways to see us and to see your film and to hear us. Thank you for being with us, Renata Simone. I appreciate it.
Michael, thank you so much for your interest in the film.
And thank you, Jesse Brooks.
Thank you, Michael.
And thank you, Ned Davis.
Thank you.
And thank you, our listeners. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks also to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauberg, and Amy Machado. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.